Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, the US and UK ban Russian oil, and the European Union announced its plans to drastically shrink its reliance on gas from Russia. Will high prices undermine global energy security? Higher fuel costs and longer routes to bypass Russian airspace. How sanctions against Moscow are battering the global aviation industry, with ticket prices and freight rates poised to go up. And Sri Lanka reels from food shortages and power cuts as it struggles to repay its foreign debt and pay for imports. Is the country on the verge of defaulting on its debt? It is the world's largest exporter of natural gas and the second largest oil exporter. Energy is Russia's biggest source of income. But now, US President Joe Biden has imposed a ban on Russian oil and gas in response to the invasion of Ukraine. The UK says that it will phase out Russian oil by the end of the year, while the European Union is aiming to cut gas imports by two-thirds this year. Now, the move will worsen inflation and push up fuel prices, and Washington is scrambling to find alternative suppliers. Al Jazeera's Priyanka Gupta reports.
A major escalation of U.S. economic sanctions against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden is going after President Vladimir Putin's most lucrative industry.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine.
Biden acknowledged the latest sanctions could push up U.S. gas prices. Consumers are already paying on average more than $4 a gallon, up from $2.77 just a year ago, due to high inflation as the economy recovers from the pandemic. But it's Europe that will feel the effect of moving away from Russian energy more acutely than the US. The European Union imports 27% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia. The bloc plans to cut its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But experts say this decision will mean difficult compromises.
There'll have to be additional use of nuclear, which is supposed to be phased out in certain countries. There'll have to be more coal use, which won't help climate goals.
The U.S. is seeking to persuade OPEC members to ramp up output. Among them, only Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait have spare capacity. And Washington is also turning to countries it has shunned and imposed sanctions on. It's making overtures to Venezuela and attempting to seal a nuclear deal with Iran that could bring more oil into the market. Priyanka Gupta for Counting the Cost.
Joining us now from London, Toby Whittington, lead economist at Oxford Economics. Toby, great to have you with us on Counting the Cost. Is this ban on Russian imports of oil into the US largely symbolic? What is it? The US uses something like 8% of Russian oil. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is a largely symbolic move. You know, obviously, US demand or US usage of Russian oil is fairly limited, and I think substituting out to alternative suppliers, I think probably within the North American market would be possible. There may be some sort of frictional costs in the process of doing that, but those would be sort of temporary and quite moderate, and so we wouldn't expect too much of a price shock from this movement.
In terms of oil, is there anyone who could plug the gap? The US appears to be making attempts to repair relations with Venezuela, which of course has huge oil stocks, but its infrastructure isn't in any fit shape at the moment. And of course, the Iran nuclear deal talks could come to some sort of fruition and sanctions might be lifted on Iran. Could Venezuela and Iran perhaps help offset the shock?
I think those are both two key markets, and certainly given the situation we're in, there is an impetus now to try to bring those two countries back into the global oil market. Discussions are ongoing. As you say, I think Venezuela's oil infrastructure is in a slightly poorer state than what it is in Iran. I think IEA estimates put them at around about 700,000 barrels a day that they could start exporting. Iran is a bit higher, roughly around about 1.3 million barrels a day that they could put out by the end of the year, and with potential to up it even further. So those are important markets. But I think the key sort of producers are, as ever, the major OPEC producers, Saudi Arabia and the UAE now as well.
Okay, and you talk about Europe looking to wean itself off Russian gas. We're not talking about oil here, and perhaps its plans being a little overly optimistic at the moment. Who would fill the gap there? Would it be countries like Qatar, Australia? I mean, you're looking at shipping gas from the other side of the world to Europe. I mean, can that be done?
You know, the three major sort of LNG exporters are the US, Qatar and Australia. I think Australia is pretty out of the picture. They overwhelmingly supply the Australian market, so the Asian market. And, of course, getting gas shipping gas from Australia to Europe is a huge endeavor. I think it would come primarily from the US and Qatar. It's not entirely clear that enough export capacity exists at the moment. So as part of the EU plan, they want to withdraw, reduce dependence on Russian gas by 2/3 within 2022. So that's 9 months essentially to do it. And half of that 2/3 saving is going to come from extra LNG imports, which roughly equates to around about a 60 to 70% increase in EU imports of LNG. I think that's highly optimistic given current export capacities and also EU import capacities of LNG. I think if they could reduce dependence by maybe 1/3, that would be very good. I think 2/3 is probably pushing it too far, really.
And is this, I mean, this is all about sanctioning Russia. It's a financial penalty for Russia. It's aimed at causing economic harm to Russia. Ultimately, though, is Russia still going to be able to sell its oil and gas? Will there be buyers out there? Will it be able to still sell at market price? Is it really going to hurt Russia?
Well, I think undoubtedly in the long run, I think, you know, if Russia loses access to Western markets, it's lost access to the US. If it also loses access to Europe, as Europe seems to be implying, you know, that will have impact on Russian on demand for Russian oil, which should reduce the price that they can pay. I mean, they're going to be able to sell to other countries, China, India, Asian countries, and so on. But that sort of reduced number of buyers will necessarily, I think, reduce the amount of price they can pay. I think that's true also of gas, as Europe seeks to wean itself off Europe, Russian gas. Russia is in the process of transiting to China, building new pipeline infrastructure to supply gas from the Yamal field down into China. But that's a massive infrastructure effort that will take some time to come online. And also China will be in quite a strong bargaining position, of course. You know, with Russia not having many other customers, China will be able to leverage that position to negotiate themselves a better deal. So, yeah, in sum, I think Russia's the price that they can achieve for their energy exports will undoubtedly go down.
Toby, it's been great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you.
The surge in oil prices has pushed the cost of global jet fuel to a 14-year high. Airlines and travellers are facing steep fare increases, just as air travel was beginning to recover after COVID-19. Well, adding to the burden of high prices are the circuitous flight paths needed to avoid Russian airspace right now. The biggest impact is on flights between Europe and Asian destinations like Japan, South Korea and China. Longer flight times lead to higher staff costs, limited cargo carrying ability, and they raise maintenance costs. And Russian airlines have also been hit by the airspace bans. They won't be able to access parts and services that they'd sourced from abroad. To discuss all of this, joining us from London, Peter Morris, chief economist at the aviation consultancy Ascend by Cirium. Peter, good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. Just as airlines were beginning to spot a patch of clear skies after the horrible time they've been through with the pandemic, here we have more turbulence caused by higher oil prices. I mean, just how bad an impact is this going to have on an already suffering aviation sector?
Well, it's yet another negative. I mean, if you look at this proportion of global aviation that is linked directly to Russia, it's of the order of 6% or so, which you can say, you know, could be managed without. But on the other hand, what you're talking about is yet another negative factor. And we haven't even got to the level of the increase in fuel prices that appears to have been linked to this whole invasion.
So what will higher oil prices, higher fuel prices mean for the likes of you and I, the people who use the airlines? Is that going to lead to higher ticket prices for us?
It's inevitably going to lead to higher ticket prices, but there will be a kind of differential in the effect. So when you're travelling, for example, within Europe, the proportion of the ticket that's fuel is lower, whereas when you're travelling to Australia, for example, it's a much higher proportion. So it will mean that short haul is impacted less than long haul travel that's more than 3 hours.
Not only is fuel going to cost more, but airlines are going to have to use more of it to fly around Russian airspace, a vast part of the globe that they now have to avoid.
I think there's two factors here. First of all, yes, it will increase flight times by between 1 and 4 hours between Europe and Asia. But on the other hand, if you look at the level of closure on international services that's taking place in Japan and China at the moment, that actually that traffic is very badly hit anyway. But again, this is yet another negative that's added in. One thing it does mean is that the airlines that have newer fleets that are more fuel efficient, saving perhaps 20% of fuel on journeys, will actually have a competitive benefit compared with others. They'll still be suffering in paying the higher costs, but they will have something of a competitive advantage.
And what does the ban on Russian aircraft flying into European airspace, for example, what does that mean for Russia's aviation sector?
Well, it's been very badly hit, as symbolised by the Aeroflot withdrawing services internationally from the 8th of March. So as a consequence, they're not flying for fear that the planes could be impounded. There's something like 500 aircraft, according to our databases, that are leased into Russian entities from international leasing companies. And those effectively, the leases have to be terminated by the 28th of March. So that means that any aircraft that's then flying outside can be impounded. And also, under international law, the airlines are supposed to be handing those aircraft back.
If they don't hand them back, because they simply can't at the moment due to circumstance, what does that mean for the international leasing companies? They're going to lose money, of course, because these aircraft are sitting on the ground in Russia and they can't get to them.
It is a major challenge one way or another. And the thing is, we can only look at the unfolding impact of the sanctions and so on. But it is clearly one of the major impacts that will be seen in Russia among Russian air travellers, realising you can't fly as easily or as cheaply as you did before. And it will mean that, for example, the Middle Eastern airlines who do fly to Russia will actually have a significant captive market.
We lost a lot of airlines due to the pandemic. It just wasn't survivable for many of the smaller airlines or those running on very tight operational budgets. With this continuing agony now, with the airspace restrictions around Russia, with the increasing fuel prices, do you think that we're likely to see other airlines going under?
It's going to increase the pressures. Ultimately, it's really what the impact on individual countries' GDP is, because it's GDP and the ability of people to buy tickets effectively that drives the airline business forward. And one of the concerns is that the impact in terms of GDP growth will actually reduce aviation growth as well. But you know, none of these things are positive is the basic point.
All looking a little bleak at the moment, to say the least, Peter. But anyway, thank you. I really appreciate you outlining all of that for us. Peter Morris there in London.
Thank you.
Now, food shortages, power cuts and long lines for expensive fuel. Sri Lanka is facing its worst economic crisis since independence in 1948. International rating agencies are warning that it's on the verge of defaulting on its debts. But the government has refused to seek an IMF bailout and insists that it can handle the crisis on its own. Al Jazeera's Manel Fernandez reports from Colombo.
Spending hours in queues has become the norm across Sri Lanka. Starting with food, rice, sugar and milk powder, now it's cooking gas and diesel that are in short supply.
I haven't eaten from the morning and I can't even go drink some water. I would lose my place otherwise.
After spending so many hours in queues, we can only run about 2.5 days. We can't keep doing this, so we appeal for this problem to be solved.
The shortages are a result of the government not having enough dollars to pay for imports. This is because its foreign earnings and reserves have been rapidly declining since 2019. Huge debt repayments have eaten into a big chunk of available resources. The crisis has affected all sectors, including public transport. Operators say they are struggling to survive from day to day.
On the one hand, there's no electricity. They cut power for 7.5 hours. The diesel stocks that come, half is given for power generation. It's only half the stock that's used for everything else.
After months of coping, people are protesting. Here in Chilao, north of Colombo, fishermen complain they don't have fuel for their boats.
My husband can't go to sea. There's no diesel. I hope those responsible are struck by lightning.
In Colombo, a silent protest. Enough is enough, says one banner. Stop ruining my country, reads another.
Months of skyrocketing prices and shortages of food, medicine, cooking gas and fuel have made Sri Lankans frustrated and angry. To make matters worse, they've suffered through the worst power cuts to be imposed in more than 25 years.
7.5 hour interruptions a day are causing chaos among all segments of the population. Sri Lanka's public utilities regulator says it has been pushing to solve the power crisis.
This has become a national issue. So the attention has not been paid by the political hierarchy, then and now, and the other authorities. So we have been fighting, you know, with almost everyone to sort out this issue.
Increasing prices and shortages are not unique to Sri Lanka. But people here say their leaders have aggravated the situation through years of corruption and mismanagement. Manel Fernandez, Al Jazeera, Colombo.
Well, Sri Lanka's usable foreign currency reserves have plunged below $1 billion. Now the rising cost of oil imports is shrinking that even further, leaving it vulnerable to a debt default. The tourism sector, a major foreign exchange earner, was battered by the Easter attacks of 2019 and, of course, the coronavirus pandemic. And now two countries vital to Sri Lanka's tourism market are at war. Russia and Ukraine had been the first and third largest source of visitors this year. A failed drive to become the world's first 100% organic farming nation hurt food security. Sri Lanka was forced to import rice. The tea crop, the nation's top export, was devastated. Sri Lanka now wants China, a major lender, to restructure its debt. And it's negotiating a $1 billion relief package from China's geopolitical rival, India. Let's talk all of this through now with Deshal Damel in Colombo. He's an economist and research director at Verite Research. He served as economic advisor to Sri Lanka's finance ministry from 2017 to 2019. Deshal, great to have you with us. Is Sri Lanka on the verge of defaulting on its debt?
So Sri Lanka is facing a very challenged situation on its foreign exchange reserve position right now. So its usable reserves, that's excluding a $1.5 billion Chinese yuan swap, amounted to just $734 million at the end of February. That's import coverage of around 2.5 weeks. Now, in the months of February and March, Sri Lanka had liabilities maturing amounting to $1.8 billion. So the gap between usable reserves and maturing liabilities is clearly very, very high and not in Sri Lanka's favor. Now, there was a deferment of $900 million of an ACU payment, Asian Clearing Union payment, that was due to be paid earlier this week, that has been deferred by 2 months. So that does provide a little bit of leeway for the next few weeks. But overall, Sri Lanka faces a very challenging situation on its external debt and its foreign exchange reserves.
And the government says that it can manage this situation on its own without resorting to help from the IMF. Is that a wise strategy, do you think?
So I would think for Sri Lanka, the most prudent option now is to enter into negotiations with its creditors with a view to restructuring its external debt, to restructure debt in a preemptive manner. And such a restructuring program would ideally be underpinned and supported by an IMF agreement. An IMF agreement in that situation would be able to unlock some options of bridge financing that will help Sri Lanka to build up reserves in the interim whilst it goes through a debt restructuring process. Now, even if somehow Sri Lanka is able to meet its maturing debt liabilities by scraping together some swaps or government-to-government transactions, it's still doing so at the expense of critical imports for the economy, imports such as fuel, cooking gas, and a number of other imported commodities, as a result of which citizens are facing a degree of hardship. So really, the best balance from Sri Lanka's economic perspective in the long term would be to preemptively restructure its external debt liabilities.
This an issue that we've discussed many, many times on Counting the Cost. How much of this current crisis is due to the fact that Sri Lanka is so indebted to China?
So I would say that the current situation is not entirely because of Sri Lanka's liabilities to China. So if you look at the upcoming maturities over the next few years, typically around 20% of the maturing liabilities are liabilities that are owed to China. The bulk of the liabilities actually arise out of Sri Lanka's borrowings from commercial markets or from financial markets, particularly international sovereign bonds, syndicated loans, and so on. So whilst there is a component of Chinese debt and Chinese liabilities in this equation, I would not say that it is the predominant cause of the challenges Sri Lanka is facing right now.
All right. What is the cause? We talked a few moments ago about the now scrapped policy to switch to 100% organic farming. That affected exports and food security. We talked about the tea industry, the biggest export earner, suffering. Is there one single cause, or is just Sri Lanka in the wrong place at the wrong time economically at the moment?
So the scrapping of chemical fertilizer, replacing with organic fertilizer, that we don't have evidence as yet to be able to attribute it to, say, the decline in tea exports in January. Survey data conducted by Verita Research does suggest that farmers do expect significant decline in yield. So there would be some impact from that policy as well. But Sri Lanka's real problem is the fact that it lost access to global credit markets around early 2020, just before the pandemic hit. By losing access to global credit markets, it's been not been able to raise capital to be able to refinance its maturing debt. So it has had to pay back debt using its reserves. And today, reserves have, as a result, dwindled down to the levels that we are at. And that's really the crux of the problem that Sri Lanka faces in foreign exchange.
With Sri Lanka's tourism industry taking such a big hit, first of all, from the pandemic and now due to the war in Ukraine, is there anything that the government can do to increase its foreign currency reserves, you know, to earn currency that it desperately needs?
Yeah, so certainly the war in the Ukraine does have an impact on Sri Lanka's tourism, which was just recovering in the last few months. Around 25% of arrivals in the last few months have been from either Ukraine or Russia. So the conflict there certainly does have an impact on the overall balance of payments, as does, of course, the knock-on impacts that we're seeing in global commodity prices, particularly oil, gas, wheat, and a number of other important food products as well, because Sri Lanka is a net importer. So certainly the current geopolitical challenges do not work in Sri Lanka's favor in terms of its current account. That said, the government has taken some important positive steps in recent days. It floated the rupee, the central bank floated the Sri Lankan rupee a couple of days ago, and that certainly is a step in the right direction towards encouraging more inflows through formal banking channels that can help the buildup of reserves. So that's certainly a positive. The central bank also recently raised policy interest rates by 100 basis points at last week's monetary board meeting. Again, a positive in terms of demand management and towards building up reserves. So there are steps in the right direction. There's still a long way to go in terms of further fiscal tightening, further moves on the monetary side as well. If that is underpinned by an IMF program and debt restructuring, I would think that is really the way forward for Sri Lanka to really sustainably build up its reserves and to be able to both meet its external debt repayments and provide the imports that are required to sustain the economy.
Darshal, it's been really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us if you want to comment on anything that you've seen. You can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Please use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or you can drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. There is, as always, plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page. And there you'll find individual reports, links, even entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.